Welcome to another edition of the Three Horsemen podcast. My name is John E.O. Stevens, and I am in the first chair tonight. And with me are my two colleagues in crime, Fred and Jeff, and I will let them introduce themselves each. So let's go with Fred first.
Hi, this is Fred Kish. I tweet as at Fred Kish, and I blog at Bernal, B-E-R-N-A-L, Alpha. And I'm occasionally a SF Signal irregular.
Occasionally. When they get around to having us on. Hi, this is Jeff Patterson. I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at baddaystudio.com. And I am at JeffPatterson11 on Twitter.
And I am a writer and blogger for SF Signal and other places. And I am also on Twitter at ErudyteOgre. And I have a Tumblr, I have a Facebook, I have far too much social media in my life right now. So that's the three of us, and tonight we're going to do something a little different, something we've been wanting to do since we started this podcast. We wanted to have a discussion about a classic science fiction novel. And the work that we have chosen for our first discussion is Samuel R. Delaney's Nova. For those of you who don't know the book, I'll try to do a brief synopsis, and I'd like Fred and Jeff to leap in and fill in the blanks on the book. Basically, Nova isn't this one of his last sort of space operas? Was this the last one?
This was the last novel he wrote before the multi-year gap that was broken by, at least from SF's viewpoint, with Dahlgren.
With Dahlgren, right.
Right right before it were Babel 17.
Right.
And Empire Star.
Okay.
And right. You also might want to mention, or we might want to mention, a few other works that have appeared in a short story collection, currently I and Gamora, that are sort of related. And he has themes in this that also carry over in things like the Towers trilogy, as well as the much later stars like, oh, I can't ever remember that one.
Stars in My Pocket like Grains of Sand.
Yes.
There you go. Yeah. So this is, in some ways, it's an auspicious book because it marks the end of a period for him, essentially, and then there's a break, and and you can sort of see it in some ways as a culmination, in some ways as a continuance. Basically, to try to summarize this really quickly, Nova is a classic quest tale. There's an objective that has to be accomplished by the hero protagonist. So he assembles his ragtag band of outsiders to aid him in his quest, and they go on a very long journey and make stops on the way to figure out how they will achieve their objective. And the objective, without getting spoilery, is in a sense achieved at great cost.
But I think, John, with the book published in 1968, we can...
Spoiler alert!
We can break a few spoilers.
Yes. So... It is the story of Lorc Von Rey, who is a rich, bratty yacht racer. Sorry, space yacht racer. I should make that clear. A rich, bratty space yacht racer whose family essentially is very high up and, if not, runs the Pleiades Federation, which is one of the major sociopolitical organizations in the galaxy in the 32nd century when this book is set. And what happens is he runs into the children of another great family who are high up in the Draco Earth Confederation, and whose great claim to fame is that their family's corporation pretty much controls the production and supply of the ultimate source of energy in the galaxy, a material called Illyrian. And they make all the star drives, and they make everything, all the batteries and things that power everything that everyone uses. And this virtual monopoly is given them and the Draco Earth Confederacy a vast amount of power. And you guys can jump in at any point about the how the conflicts work out, but basically Von Rey has become obsessed with acquiring Illyrian himself in order to break their family's monopoly on the galaxy.
Well, it's mostly been produced artificially, but in the Outer Colonies, which is the third political entity in this book, mm-hmm. they're starting to mine it.
Right.
And the two families realize that, first off, the cost of making starships is going down, and the ease of getting Irillion is going up. So at some point, the power is going to shift. Mm. And the Red family, Prince Ruby and their father, want to keep the old ways going. And the Lork's family wants to push things forward and get the power shifted over to them.
Right.
One other thing that should be brought up as a piece of background, aside from the families and cosmopolitical climate that exists in there, is the use of tarot cards is actually a legitimate form of intuiting data, though not necessarily observing it directly.
And another right. big
kind
element,
of, which is kind of a big disconnect for some people. So
right, and another big element is the use of cyborg technology.
Yes,
mm-hmm. Right.
People, if you want to use the term that cyberpunk used a lot, people jack into machinery directly, whether it's a lawnmower or running a factory or a starship, and this has changed the way that people work. You're no longer just a minor cog in the machine. You are the machine, and you get pride from doing that.
Right. So there's a lot in the novel that is innovative for the time. The direct machine interface, the way that he tries to do things like economics is pretty distinctive, and all of this is wrapped around this story that is actually not a very convoluted story. It's a very, I mean, in some ways, I think this is Delaney's most
straightforward, sure.
Straightforward plot-wise book. And the prose is the same way. There's a lot less of the literary flourishes that he employs in other books, mm-hmm. Especially after this point, from Dahlgren on out. So that's, yeah, I think that's good. That's a good basic outline of the story. So, in talking about this, the first thing I thought that it might be interesting to discuss is how we each encountered the book and what our initial reaction was, what our first impression of the novel was.
Ooh.
Can you remember that far back, Jeff?
Yes, I can. my first edition that I purchased was the 1980, I believe, 10th printing. Which was 1980, so I'm going to say I read it in 81, because I remember I read it in the springtime. That would have made me 18. And I read it pretty much I approached it the same way I approached just about every other science fiction novel that I had read up until that time. And I remember thinking that it pretty much delivered pretty much the same way as most of the other books that I had read. It wasn't until after I had read it that I started reading stuff like John Bruner and Arthur Byron Cover, and really started broadening my horizons a little bit. And my revisit of the book took place at the end of the 80s. Actually, it might have been 1990 by that point. I'll talk about that in a little bit. And at that point, I took a very different approach to it and got a very different set of rewards delivered to me for it. But yeah, it was pretty much one of a pile of books. There was a lot of Silverberg in it, in that pile, and Asimov and Clark and the usual. I think I was just starting to get into Brian Aldiss at that point, too. that was my first encounter with it.
My first encounter was roughly, I'm going to say 75 or 76, which whenever Dahlgren came out, because Bantam reissued a number of his books with kind of a unified look, if not unified art. And I had read several of Delaney's shorter works by then, mostly in various Nebula or Orbit collections, things like that. I mean, it was definitely, of all the Delaney I read around that time in those editions, the one that stuck to me the most, even though I think Dahlgren outsold it by many factors. And, you know, it was, up to that point, I had read a lot of space opera, so it attracted me because of the space opera, but it also attracted me because of things like the tarot, use of the tarot. Rereadings were maybe 6, 7, 8 times since then, including 3 times this year to prepare for this podcast, in which I noticed that the edition that I read this time, which is the vintage edition, and we'll talk about this later, there's some stuff put back in which changes things for me. So that was an interesting experience.
Mm-hmm. Great. Excuse me.
As the man in the first chair chokes to death.
Choking on my nostalgia. Goodness. My encounter with this was later. I have the 12th printing of the Bantam paperback, 1983. And I think, if I remember, I read this in the fall of 83 as a high school student. And it was actually, for me, a shift of sorts. Up until that point, I'd been reading mostly Sword and Sorcery, Planetary Romance, and fairly standard kind of space opera stuff. A lot of Highland Juveniles. I'd read Tolkien, and I'd read a little bit of Le Guin. I read a lot of Sword and Sorcery, Robert E. Howard, and all of the people who ripped him off, and stuff like that. And it was actually a gift from a teacher, and it was, I think, because he was sort of giving me a lot of books to read, an attempt to shift me out of one register of science fiction into another, which it was actually great for, because it's not a shocking novel, really. Although at the time, for some people, it apparently was, including John Campbell. But it was different than a lot of the things I had read before in terms of what the book was trying to do, some of the themes that it explored, and even the way it was written was I felt markedly different than a lot of things I had already encountered. So for me, initially, it was kind of a break. It was kind of an initiation to another strata of literature, and I remember it actually pretty fondly for that. It was the first Delaney I had read. And he's become one of my favorite writers ever. So in some ways, it was a very auspicious book to read. And so my first impression is a very strong one related to it. So, and I think what has stayed with me through subsequent rereadings, and I only reread it 1.5 times this time instead of 3. So Fred wins there. With the obsessive rereading category.
It's the OCD coming through.
It is, yes. Although I read a lot of secondary stuff about it too, so, you know, there you go. But subsequent rereadings have not really changed my initial reaction to it, that strong positive reaction. Although looking at it now, after 30 years from having first read it, it's educational to go back and reread it and compare my response the first time and the second and third and fourth time, say, I read it, with it now, where despite having a pretty solid grasp of the book from so many rereadings, I still find that there are little things that surprise me, and I also find that I still have emotional reactions to things that, you know, that I know are coming and that I know are there. Before we started this podcast, we were talking about the book a little bit, and someone brought up Ruby, and I was like, oh yeah, Ruby, man, I forgot how much I disliked her. Like little things like that, and you would think after a lot of rereadings, that stuff would kind of flatten out for you, but it actually hasn't.
I think each reading that I've done over the years, I've noticed different things. I mean, this time I definitely noticed, for example, the treatment of labor a lot more. I've learned more about the tarot in the intervening years, and I've read Moby Dick a couple times since then, so I've seen the parallels with that. I mean, there's it definitely has not aged poorly, other than, you know, you could use more characters, you could use more female characters,
right?
But on the other hand, it has a economy that I love in books of the era, that it's not as, I mean, Jeff, it took you how many hours to get through Great North Road?
The audio book, yeah, it's about 3 hours long. So
right, so, you know, I mean, I love books like this, or John Boyd's Last Starship from Earth, or anything else from that era, where the guys were pounding it out on a manual typewriter, so had to really sweat what they were doing and managed to put a lot of stuff into a relatively short piece of work. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just so much in here that you could spin into whole, you know, volumes. Mm-hmm. with someone like China Mieville or whatever.
Yeah.
Sure.
It's funny you should talk about the reread, because the one thing that I did want to bring up is my second visit to this book occurred, it was 89 or 90, I forget which one, and what had happened was I was in a writing group at the time, and I found a flyer at the library where the writing group met that the Connecticut Library Association was going to have a reading club over the course of the summer, where they were going to be discussing a number of different science fiction books at assorted libraries around the state. And I went out of my way to attend as many of these as I could. But one of the ones was Nova, and it was in Ellington, Connecticut, was the library. And I think there was probably about 7 people in attendance for this discussion. And a professor from Rhode Island, and I do not recall his name, actually came and ran the discussion. And one of the reasons I was so excited about going to this one, because this reading group was going to culminate in an actual conference on science fiction at Eastern Connecticut State University that Delaney was going to be at. So we went to this thing, and the one thing that I carried out of the discussion was the fact that this professor had talked about the fact that Delaney's juggling trick in this book was keeping a balance between technology and the tarot, and that in his opinion he felt that Delaney failed in doing that. And the discussion goes on about characters and all this stuff, and I do remember there was a discussion of labor at one point, but that statement kind of stuck with me through the course of the talk, and I asked him to revisit that. I said, can you give me some examples as to what you mean? And he talked about the fact that he felt that Delaney really hadn't made the case for tarot being legitimate. He thought it was too big of a conceptual leap. And I said, okay, so this is basically you're outside of your comfort zone here, and that's why it's bothering you. So I remembered that, and I know I reread the book shortly after that again. I have to digress here a little bit, because in the television series Connections, at the very end, and why am I forgetting the host of Connections? James Burke. Thank you.
Burke, right.
At the end of it, at the end of the first series, Burke, after he's gone through all this stuff about modern technology and modern society and how technology and science and knowledge all, you know, basically accumulate into defining us now, he does this whole thing where he talks about Hinduism. And it's this very long, very almost pastoral explanation of Hinduism and how for the people who adhere to it, it answers all the questions regarding the universe to the same extent that science and our understanding of the universe now does for the majority of Western society. And he's not suggesting that we all become Hindus, but he's saying that we have to be aware of this as we proceed through life. We have to understand why there are alternate viewpoints to things, you know, and that go out of their way to become complete systems that manage to address everything. I give you that aside because when I reread it this time, having the benefit of having studied so many religions and belief systems and philosophies, etc., that as I read it this time, I kept saying to myself, you know, he really could have picked something else besides from the tarot that would have made this, if not slightly more conceptual, at least a little bit more compelling. Now, yes, I understand that, as Fred said, he banged it out on a manual typewriter and et cetera, et cetera. But that whole James Burke monologue was running in the back of my head every time one of these sequences came up where they did this. I just think about all the various alternate religions and alternate belief systems that science fiction has given us and delivered, both in its golden age and more contemporary. And this reread, that almost became like almost the predominant nagging sensation that was running through my head. Not that I felt that he fell short. I think he actually succeeds in doing a pretty good job of keeping it afloat during the course of the book. It just kind of, I started running all these alternate scenarios in my head of, wouldn't it have been interesting if he had, you know, used this instead, if he had used numerology or something like that.
Well, given when it was written, maybe the tarot had a attraction for being something that people were not as familiar with at that point.
So you got a good point.
When did Dick do? I'm gonna call it by the alternate title or the alternate world title, The Grasshopper Lies Heavy. Man in the High Castle. Right. Yeah, when did that come out? Maybe Delaney read that and was influenced to use the tarot because he had come across the I Ching. In Dick. And I mean, Zelazny was very much in the public eye at that point, mm-hmm. and made a lot of use out of Eastern religion and mythologies as well. So,
well, I think part of the thing with the tarot is, I mean, you have to remember that Delaney had this thing for archetypes,
right?
And the tarot is just packed with archetypal images. Mm-hmm. With a system of reversal as well to attempt to make it a more complicated kind of system. So I think he very intentionally chose the tarot for that quality, to talk about archetypes and to create a conceptual framework that had resonance with psychological thought, because of the way that it gets used in the book is not as it's not a reflection of reality. It is a commentary on reality, essentially, right?
It also kind of works into the things about language. He had that one paragraph about the 20th century starts off with many cultures, and by the end of the 20th century, even though he was wrong in the book, that we had gone to basically one culture and many worlds. And right. One of the things that occurred was a commonality of understanding. So it's kind of like, I mean, other science fiction writers have talked about language as being a virus or whatever, so it almost seemed like the tarot is another way of communicating ideas across time and culture.
Right.
I like that. I hadn't thought of that. I like that. You know, it's funny that you bring up, Man of the High Castle was 62. So yes, I think you've
okay.
a salient point
yep.
there. Something that you just, when you brought that up, I'm actually kind of curious in context, how much do you think this book is a product of its time?
Well, I think there's definitely a lot of product of Delaney in it. Musician, he was a musician.
Mm.
The settings in Greece and Turkey, I mean, he traveled through the area. Definitely there's a lot of characteristics that get shared across many of his books. You know, the focus on the hands. But I think it's less a product of, let's say, call it psychedelia, than some books that were written around that time were. I think it holds up a lot better. I mean, there's less emphasis on drug use than some. There's more emphasis on music, but I think that still works. The sciences is, you know, as good as it was, pretty much, for any other science fiction book.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certain things that we still don't have. I mean, this is more racially mixed than a lot of books that we read today.
Right.
That's true. Okay. When you mentioned,
yeah, it's an interesting. Yeah, it's an interesting nexus of different things. I mean, he's building on some classic SF tropes, and he's also trying to, I don't know if I would say subvert them so much as retask them.
Yeah.
I mean, the first time that I read this and the tarot was introduced, I thought it was kind of odd because a lot of the science fiction I'd read up to that point was, if not, you know, sort of rejecting of religion, treated religion as sort of a superstition, and there was, you know, the future where people aren't superstitious anymore and, you know, the past where they were. And that sort of blending of elements like the tarot into the social structure was, I thought, a really nice change. And, you know, and the racial mixing and the very casual way that it's done, too, the very casual way that almost everyone seems to have a multiracial, multiethnic background was, I thought, very well done. And it's not, you know, it's an attempt to, on Delaney's part, to present, in some sense, the world he would like to see, but also where he was hoping and thinking the world was going to go.
Mm.
And that actually rang really true to me, even though, you know, at the time I first read this, I was a teenager in an all-white high school on Cape Cod. but it really felt more real to me than a lot of the other science fiction I'd read at the time. Based on elements like that. So I think it has aged fairly well. There are elements that you can look at and pick at, like the fact that, you know, they have to use cables to plug in, and, you know,
yeah.
As things go increasingly wireless, like, you know.
Well, there's even a phone booth at one point.
Yeah.
That's right.
Even though it's a Visigraph and he uses a, you know, a handprint and whatever, it's like, wait a minute. It's like, you know, he kept the doors open so that they could hear him. Like, doors? What?
John, it's funny that you bring up the diversity of the crew and stuff like that, because something that went through my head on this reread was I thought about the almost cliche of a crew being, you know, the ragtag assemblage of either outcasts or people from, you know, disparate groupings and stuff like that, and the two things that leapt to mind were number one, the follow-up to Babylon 5, which was Crusade,
right?
And the various people that the captain had joined the crew. But the thing that really leapt to mind as I read it was the and I'll probably get death threats for this, was the show Andromeda. With the whole idea of the, you know, the Nietzscheans not being happy about being on the ship with non-Nietzscheans, and as I read it and read, you know, some of, you know, Lorik's reactions and stuff like that. And the other thing, the point I wanted to make, though, was the thing that struck me that I did not remember, and maybe this is just my interpretation of it, was the fact that everybody seemed to be possessed of great affectation in this book. And I found it funny that given the discussion of cultural solidarity that goes on in the whole thing, the fact that these characters are so affected in their various ways, and sometimes it's just subtextual and sometimes it's really out in the open. But I had not caught that at all the first two times around in reading this. And I just found it unique. Maybe I was just focusing more on the space opera aspects of it when I first read it. But that was me.
Well, it was kind of amusing to read the character of Caton, or Catton, I'm not sure how we would pronounce it, the writer who is writing a book, or writing a novel, has managed to take hundreds and thousands of words of notes without actually writing the novel.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you would go from these points where he's commenting about society to himself, to the people he's with while they're there, and they're reacting to his taking notes and, wait a minute, what are you saying that about me for? Then we get to the end of the book, and he's like, well, maybe I won't write a novel after all. I mean, how many people do we know like that?
Well, yeah. which feeds right into the last line of the novel itself.
I mean,
that's the first time I read that, actually, I was really frustrated. I mean, I was 17 years old when I read this first time, so I wasn't used to novels that ended abruptly mid-sentence, which, you know, spoiler alert, is what happens in this novel.
Well, that's to prevent the fulfillment of a certain curse.
Exactly. But that, the way that he uses Catton as a meta-commentary on the novel itself, and on the tendency of a lot of science fiction novels to have large blocks of exposition or a lot of info dumps. At the time, certainly, I thought that was kind of a neat way to do things. I think it's been used a lot more since then. It's not quite as interesting as it used to be. But for the time, it was a great device, and I think he does a fairly good job of it. I mean, there are a few occasions where Catton is rambling on and on and on, and you just kind of want to say, "Yep, okay, can we move on now?" But there's a great line early in the novel that I actually tweeted about, where Catton basically sets himself up, you know, as basically that sort of meta narrative for the novel by saying, you know, never mind, I have a knack for this sort of extemporaneous synthesis.
There's
a lot of little great moments like that where Delany kind of clues you into the functions of characters in the novel and where things are going to go in the novel that I liked a lot. And that's still found really interesting to read even now. Especially now that I do my own writing and I'm looking for things, ways to string together a book and keep it interesting for people. That kind of stuff I thought was really well done and still resonates for me.
Another odd little occurrence that occurred while reading it this time was the fact that I was reminded at several points of Peter Watts' Blindsight. Even though when I first read Peter Watts' Blindsight, I was not reminded of this book. So, the same way that the characters sort of have to approach the given situations in their own way for specific reasons. Like I said, it's not exactly a cliche, but it's a very effective tool for embracing a scene. If you go into a given set of circumstances with your established characters knowing what their take on it is going to be, it becomes an assist for the reader.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Got any more thoughts there, John, that you want us to?
I was trying to think of other things that I caught this time. The only thing that I wanted to bring up that I caught this time was the way that history is a very omnipresent theme in the book. And from individual histories, like the mouse's history, very much informs him and how he actually gets there and who he is as a character, up to just the idea of history itself, where there are these conversations, especially from Catton, about what history is and is not. And I remember when I was reading Sven Cernay-Rone's Seven Beauties of Science Fiction, he had a line, and I actually went and went to go look it up, and he talks about Delaney's work, and he said one of the things that Delaney tries to critique in a lot of his work is the idea of the heroic agent of history.
Mm-hmm.
That idea that, you know, history builds us up to a point that, in a lot of science fiction, for example, history is constructed as having led almost inexorably to a particular technological breakthrough or political breakthrough or something like that. And the interesting thing in this novel is that, in a sense, history has ground to a halt, and culture has supposedly ground to a halt. And there's a need for history to get jump-started by some kind of essentially impossible event. And that event is, of course, the Nova, which, as Lorch von Rey says it early on in the novel, not only, you know, breaks physical laws, but breaks political and psychological laws as well. And I thought that was... it was interesting to pick up on that and think about that idea of the Nova itself and how it functions in the novel as that break. It's an opportunity and it's a risk. And what it actually does is it essentially sort of breaks the relatively stagnant history of the world and sort of exposes history as not the engine that a lot of people might have thought it was. And in a sense, jumpstarts that engine again. In another way. So there's a really, I think there's, I will say this as, you know, the scholar. I see a paper there on history in this novel. Because I just really picked up on that constantly as I reread this and all the different ways that history is problematic and fruitful and fruitless and how, you know, there is no predictability. There's guidance and there's foresight, but there's not predictability. And I think the tarot, again, is another thing that he brought in explicitly to make that point a little more forcefully. You cannot predict the future, but you can get an idea of where things are going to go.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see where things are heading. And that's really what history is a potential and a possible direction.
It's you want to know what that aspect of reminded me of it when it kept coming up was there's a bit in Hydrogen Sonata by Banks where the girl the protagonist, the girl that's been taken on the mission, the musician, is speaking to one of the culture agents, and the discussion is, yeah, all of these, every single society that we encounter goes through this. They go through all their upheavals and they go through their expansions and they go through all this stuff and they do one of two things. They either sublimate or they die off, and then the next generation starts doing it. And her response is, so basically you just sit there and watch all these races while they screw up. And he was like, yes, pretty much. That's basically what we do. And this was almost like, rereading this book was almost like somebody dropping the needle in the middle of that process where they're starting to realize, hey, we've got a couple different ways we can be going here. So, but anything is better than where we are now.
Mm-hmm. But there's, of course, the Red family wants to keep it that way.
Right.
But the funny thing is, they're the ones that cause it because, I mean, John, you started off by saying that Lorch was a spoiled, you know, starship yachtsman.
Right.
But Prince Red is the one who sets him on the path.
That's right.
By having that big fight in that on that island in Paris, not only disfigures Lorch physically, so he's no longer the pretty boy, but sets him on the path of realizing that things have got to change.
Right. Right.
And one review I read was kind of amusing. Mentions that the genesis of Nova and novel is, of course, the same word. So you've got Caton with his novel within a novel about a Nova. and right. all the shadows of Anova.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's actually some really intricate stuff going on in this, and you can read it as a quirky space opera on one level, but there's a lot of stuff within it you can you know dig into and unpack if you really want to, which seems to me to be part of the appeal is that you know you can kind of choose a level to read it at and enjoy it at that level, or you can go a little deeper, read a little more deeply into it and see more stuff to think about and enjoy. So to me, that's really what the joy of the novel is that it's a good novel on a number of different levels, and you can access it in a number of different ways. And as a reader, you can find all kinds of things to think about and play with in ways that going back to initial impressions, hadn't seen as much of in a lot of the novels I had read to that point.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'll mention to everyone, the editions changed throughout the years. The second edition that I've got in my collection is the vintage trade paperback, which is the one we will include in the show notes. There are some restorations to that when I read it this time, I read it in this edition, not my Bantam edition. I'm like, wait a minute, what the? Because there's this to show what a nasty character Prince Red is. He spent several decades destroying a minor character from the beginning of the book that kind of drops off the story. So you'll get, I think, more out of the book if you get the later edition.
Right.
Yeah, now I got to go reread it again. Thanks. Appreciate it.
I've just sold more books. There you go.
Exactly.
Which makes John happy.
And that is the edition that's in print right now. So see, there you go.
Yeah, no ebook, alas.
No,
Vintage,
no,
for some reason. Yeah, Vintage has got some ebooks from Delaney, but not this one. And not Dahlgren and a couple of the others. And you can find most of his nonfiction is in electronic format. Several of his novels, but not this for some reason. Alas.
Yeah, well, I mean, this book has had kind of a problematic history anyway. I mean, it had some publishing difficulties because of, initially, its treatment of race. There's something I had read somewhere where they were going to serialize it, I guess, and they had put it to John W. Campbell, and he said, well, with a black main character, it may not fly.
But the funny thing I find about that is that even at that time, there were other markets that might have accepted it.
Right.
Galaxy, IF, FNSF.
Right. So yeah, it's an odd moment.
I mean, they keep bringing up Campbell, but it's like he sent it to Campbell, then he gave up.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's any way to draw a parallel to if somebody did that today.
Yeah, I'm not. I can't think of one actually.
Yeah,
but any final thoughts?
I would urge people to go out and read it,
because
I still find it as fresh and exciting today as when I first read it, and I think it's something that people will read and help. It will help them appreciate other works, later works, even more.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, you can go out and buy a deck of tarot cards and, you know, impress all your friends.
That's right.
It also needs to be said that this book, somebody mentioned cyberpunk earlier, and this book definitely, you know, I don't want to say it built that sandbox, but it certainly was a big leap towards moving towards that type of stuff. I mean, there's certainly other books where man communicates directly to machines as part of their, you know, sensory apparatus and data gathering. But this book, it was almost in that respect a little bit of new weird as well, because it just kind of dropped it in without that. You know, if that book had been written during the golden age of science fiction, that would have been the whole thing of the book. This crew would be going out using this technology for the first time, and that's where they run into things, where in here it's simply yet another tool that they have at their disposal.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I agree. As far as my final thoughts go, like I said, I was actually pleasantly surprised to be able to reread it and not only still enjoy it, but find other things to think about and to take away from the text, which to me is really the hallmark of a really great novel, is if you can go back to it 30 years after you first read it and there's still fresh things you can draw out of it, that's a pretty compelling work. And I would definitely think more people should read this book, because it's a pivotal moment in Delaney's history. Mm-hmm. And it's in some ways a very significant science fiction novel as well. And it almost bridges in some ways the gap between the more classic space opera strains and to some extent the new wave. I mean, it's certainly not I wouldn't call it a new wave novel, but I think it responds to some of the things that new wave was responding to.
Yeah.
In a way, trying to circle back to some classic tropes and rework them and play with some of the science fiction standards, and show that there were fresh things you could do with that still. So I would highly recommend it too for people to go back and read. So I think those are our final thoughts on that. And the next thing we usually do on the podcast is we will talk about culture we have consumed recently.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And yes. And I believe we're going to pin Fred to the wall in this segment. So should we start with Fred?
Well, what John is mentioning here is the fact that I've been following along with Fred on Twitter as he watched a number of the Marvel Universe movies. And I was kind of curious because, as Fred likes to mention a little more than I think he should, I do tend to ride him about his comic book reading.
Well, you're not the only one.
but I'm actually more interested because the only real outsider opinion that I have is that of my wife. And God knows I can't criticize her opinion. So I was kind of curious as to what Fred had thought of the movies that he had watched so far.
Well, what happened was Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. came on, and a lot of people were talking about that, but several people told me, you really have to watch all those Marvel movies first. I'm like, God. So I managed to get it whittled down that I should watch Thor, Iron Man, and the Avengers. I could skip the Hulk, either version. And obviously avoid Spider-Man, because if people don't know, I'm just basically not a comic reader. I mean, Jeff's pointed to me, you know, a couple titles that I've read and enjoyed. I've picked up a couple titles on my own, but they're really not what many of us grew up, you know, the caped superheroes. That's just something that's really not appealed to me. So I rented and watched in one weekend Iron Man 1, Iron Man 2, Thor, and Captain America. I still haven't gotten to Avengers yet because of time constraints. Oh. And I've watched all the episodes so far of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And it's been something of a mixed bag. I mean, overall, you know, Iron Man 2 got a little annoying with the angst and the emo. And, you know, Thor, I was like, oh, God, not another movie about daddy issues. But each have had, I mean, I've enjoyed them overall. Each have had some really good bright spots, and luckily one of those bright spots has been Agent Coulson, who's carried over to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And I really like, I think what Marvel is doing by tying everything together, it just has worked so much better than, like, even Star Trek. Definitely better than what DC has done. I mean, DC just seems to be a constant cycle of, hey, let's do another origin story. Mm-hmm. Hey, let's do another. But we got to do it. you know, it's a new generation of people. They've never seen Superman before. Let's do another origin story. It's like, oh, God, not another origin story. Yeah, so I find their approach to be very interesting. And, you know, they've been a lot of explosions, not too much death, but been fun movies overall.
Hmm. Oh, I can't wait till you watch Avengers then.
I mean, as far as the TV series is concerned, I mean, I know it seems to be the opinions were wildly divergent, but we've enjoyed it. My daughter and I, we know nothing about any of the backstory other than the movies. It's something that I can turn my brain off and just enjoy and laugh with laugh at Coulson a lot.
Yeah, it's been the series has been a touch more innocuous than I expected it to be. So, given how given how many ensemble intelligence and spy shows there have been that have really kind of, you know, taken the corner on two wheels so far, this one's been a little bit formulaic, but I think they're still laying stuff down. So.
Yeah, I'm unfortunately in the not very appealing camp. I did like the first episode, but the second episode was terrible. It was so poorly done.
Yeah.
And the problem for me, I think, is, except for Coulson and to a slightly lesser extent, Ming-Na's character, they're just not interesting characters.
Yeah, not only that, but... We just got through talking about diversity. Talk about a show with a lack of diversity.
Yep. Exactly. It's just so white bread.
Yeah. And given the fact that the original Nick Fury of S.H.I.E.L.D. comics, he had fully a truly, you know, ragtag band of people he had put together that actually went on these paramilitary missions with him against super spies with ultra technology, and he had the biggest freak show that you can imagine with them, and this show has kind of gone the complete opposite directions.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't tell Patrick we said that.
So what culture have you gentlemen consumed?
I am about halfway through Cowl by Neil Asher, which is really good. And I really want to know where it's going to go. As I mentioned, I just finished Great North Road by Peter Hamilton, which I thought was a beautifully nuanced, multi-level book that just kind of, I don't want to say it ran out of steam, but the threads all kind of met and tipped their hats to each other, and that was the end of it. It was good. I thought this is probably the best set of characterizations that he's done. He also used a lot of flashbacks in this book as well, which I'm not all that used to him doing. But flashbacks of the characters that are in play, as opposed to flashbacks like he did in the Dreaming Void books.
Right.
It was good. There's chapters that I'm going back and rereading in an ebook version. And I'm also, right before that, I had reread Sister Alice by Robert Reed. Hands down, one of my favorite science fiction novels ever. In my top five.
Wow.
Wow good or wow bad?
Is that it?
Yep.
No, good. That's
what about you?
I haven't read that, so I'm...
What have you read?
It has actually been on my radar. So for me, I have two books and a TV show to talk about. Yes, I don't do that very often. But the two books are, I finished Michael Sisko's new book, Member, which I'm still trying to absorb, which I have to write a review about. It's good. It's very strange in a good way. But I kind of want to go back to it and read parts of it again to make sure I know what happened. I don't know if a lot of people know who Michael Sisko is, but he's not, I don't think he's terribly well known, unfortunately, but he's a very, he's a very literary writer. He's, you could call him New Weird in some ways, but he kind of forges his own path. It's elements of fantasy and I guess what you might call magical realism, but just very strange, offbeat, but in some ways very profound explorations of people in extraordinary situations. An earlier novel of his called The Divinity Student was just serialized on Weird Fiction, on Jeff Annemar's Weird Fiction website. And that's actually a great way to get an entry point into Sisko's work is to read that, because if you like that, you'll definitely like Member and a lot of his other work as well. And I'm just finishing up Lavi Tidhar's Violent Century, which is sort of a superhero novel, but really is about how the choices you make shape your life and shape history around you. This is another book that has a pretty hefty philosophical bent to it. But it's not to impugn Michael Sisko's book, but I think Lavi's book is more accessible. It's written in a very straightforward style. There's a lot of recognizable stuff. There's superheroes, there's World War II, there's alternate history, love triangle. I mean, there's a lot of very familiar elements in it. But he really does a good job of giving you access to the characters. And he really brings to the surface this tension between personal decisions and historical consequences, which I like a lot. So I'm liking the book. I'm not quite done with it yet, but I like it so far. And I'm a big fan of his anyway. Most of his books that I've read so far, I've really liked. And if people haven't read stuff like Osama or the Bookman stuff, I would urge people to go check that stuff out, because it's pretty smashing stuff. And then since we were talking about, you know, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and I was all down on poor old Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I thought I would mention. Well, it's reading people's responses. They're very charged. There are very few neutral opinions about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah,
very few. But a series that I have actually liked more is Arrow. The first season became available on Netflix. I ended up watching it in pretty rapid succession the first season. And it's got its shortcomings, but there was some really interesting stuff. I mean, I could see them struggling with the limitations of TV more than anything else with the show, in trying to present this character who they're trying to make morally complex and at the same time have grafted on, you know, some pretty common melodrama tropes from television. But the fusion works sometimes, and the actor who plays Oliver Queen, I was prepared to not like, but once you get to through the first few episodes and see what the character's like, you kind of realize what you don't like about him are things that are part of his pre-Arrow character, and when you start to see things more starkly in terms of character development, you get. You know, you like the character more, and it's a more interesting character to follow. The thing I actually love the most about the actor is that whenever he's in a conversation with people that has nothing to do with his mission to save the city, you can always see the actor take a second to put on his human concern mask first for the conversation. and there's actually some really good acting. The actor who plays John Diggle, whose name I don't know off the top of my head, is a pretty good actor. Most of them do their jobs quite well. The actress who plays the Oliver Queen's sister, I'm not liking a lot, but I think in a certain sense she has a thankless role, because she's really just kind of brought in as, you know, a subplot to complicate his life, and she hasn't really come into her own as a character. But I found a lot to like in that, and I've started watching the second season now, and I'm not sure if the second season is going to be quite as good as the first, but... I think it's something that's certainly worth watching, and that I found much more engaging, quite honestly, than Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
No, that's a fair point. Hey, you know, one other thing I did want to mention, I totally forgot about. Great Performances on PBS has been showing The Hollow Crown, which is the Shakespeare's Henry ad. And I'm up. I just finished Henry IV, Part 2. I highly recommend it for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's interesting to see the four plays done almost with a sense of continuity to them. Tom Hiddleston plays Prince Hal in the last three movies, and it's kind of interesting seeing his arc. I'm very much looking forward to watching Henry V. A lot of great actors show up in it, but the thing that kept going through my mind, Sam Mendes was the executive producer of this, and in watching it, in watching the use of locations, in watching the sparing way in which sets are used, and in watching the actual the color palette that they are using for the course of this series of plays to give it its texture and mood, it's very difficult to not think that maybe they were trying to appeal to Game of Thrones fans, especially some sequences in Richard II, which were like, wow, this is right out of season two of Game of Thrones. it wouldn't have come up that they have done a slightly different job with the way they shot it or the way they had their characters play off one another. Some settings liberties are taken, but for the most part, the plays are, you know, they are abridged versions of them, but they are very good abridgments. And but so far, I've really been liking it.
Good.
Oh, great. So any final thoughts before we close up?
Read.
We talked enough.
Read. Yeah. I think we've had a pretty good conversation.
Yep. Oh, yes.
And next time we get together, we have to talk about our Christmas lists.
Oh, yeah. Yep. That should be fascinating.
I had actually planned on keeping Vandermeer's Wonder Book on my Christmas list, but I finally broke down and just ordered it for myself.
Yeah, it's my fault.
There you go.
I said, no, I'm not waiting 2.5 months for this.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen. As always, a pleasure.
Thank you.
We hope all of you listeners have enjoyed our podcast tonight. So don't forget to check the show notes. We have lots of links to Nova for purchase and for more information on the novel itself and on the author, Samuel Delany. And thanks, guys. It's been great.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Yep. Good night.